So before I begin my lecture, I want to just say a real thank you to Linka for inviting me to participate in the East and West Learning Club. You can go to the website at eawlc.org to find out more about all the different events that EAWC offers. And I look forward to our next lecture. I'd like to welcome you to the July lecture for the East and West Learning Club. Tonight we're going to discuss Aristotle's Poetics and the Rhetoric. We're going to start with the Rhetoric and then move on to the Poetics. The first slide in our lecture is the painting on the cover of the Penguin edition of the Poetics. It shows Terentius in the middle, and he is a playwright. He's being surrounded by the performance of a comedy, and as you can see, things are very crazy all around him. I don't know that this is really imitating life, but Terentius certainly imitated Greek plays, and Shakespeare imitated Terentius. In fact, there's been a lot of imitation going around over the past 2,000 years. And the theory of Aristotle is that plays and poetry are an imitation of something, an imitation of life, he says. Next, here is the picture on the cover of the Penguin edition of The Rhetoric by Aristotle. This painting shows Mercury, the god, inspiring eloquence in learned men. This painting is from the 15th century. Now, Aristotle does not talk much about the god Mercury, but the idea that men need eloquence is very much a part of his book on rhetoric. We looked at Sophocles in last month's lecture for the East and West Learning Club. Sophocles was an ancient Greek playwright, and his plays, Oedipus Rex and Antigone, were what we discussed last month. And that's convenient because some of the things we talk about tonight have to do with ancient Greek tragedy. Aristotle was familiar with Oedipus Rex, and Aristotle mentions Oedipus as an example of good tragedy, for example. Aristotle also mentions Plato in connection with rhetoric, and Aristotle mentions his theory of what is good in life. Maybe you will remember we discussed Plato's Symposium a few months ago. At that time, we discussed Platonic ideas of what was good, what was the good thing in life. What makes our actions good? Aristotle's ideas are a little different, but you will see some connections with Plato because Plato was Aristotle's teacher. I picked the Rhetoric and the Poetics to look at tonight because they are still a major source of ideas today about the importance of art and literature and film. It doesn't matter that we disagree or we think Aristotle might have been wrong, these ideas still were greatly influential. Some of his ideas are still believed and taught in schools today, and that in itself makes them important. So let's talk about Aristotle's book on rhetoric first. Let's see what Aristotle means by rhetoric. Aristotle starts off by saying that rhetoric is the counterpart of dialectic. Why does he do this, and why does he mention dialectic? What is dialectic, we wonder? Why is he starting off by talking about dialectic when, in fact, his goal is to define rhetoric? Well, dialectic is basically dialogue or argument. So we read the Symposium a couple of months ago in the East and West Learning Club. The Symposium is about dialectic. It is a dialectic. The Symposium presents arguments between people, between opposing forces. And so reading these dialogues is a way of teaching philosophy. As we listen to the dialogue, we learn which idea is better, whose idea wins the war of words. And as we saw in the Symposium, the Socratic dialogue is the way that Plato likes to present his philosophical ideas. He likes to put the ideas in the mouths of certain characters, Aristophanes, Diotima, Phaedrus, Eryximachus, and so on. Plato wants us to think about the ideas as a form of question and answer. The theory of how to make a good dialogue is the theory of the dialectic. An important thing to know, though, is that Plato really dislikes rhetoric. Plato thinks rhetoric is a kind of dishonest thing. He thinks rhetoric is the art of persuading people to believe in things, and from one perspective, that kind of thing is immoral. It's a bad way to go about doing things in the world. Why would you want to persuade people about something? You would only want to persuade someone of something if you want something else. To give an example, look at all the people who try to persuade others. Politicians want to persuade people about things. Perhaps a politician wants to persuade the people to pass a law that will bring money to the politician's friend. That's dishonest. Or perhaps a lawyer tries to persuade a judge that a man is guilty, and then that man faces the death sentence and is executed. And in fact, that is what happened to Socrates. And so Plato was angry about the role persuasion had played in the death of Socrates. Plato blamed not only the people who conspired to kill Socrates, but the methods that they used. Plato called those people the sophists. The methods of persuasion that they used, which were false and unfair and cruel, this was sophistry. And Plato equated sophistry with rhetoric. Plato said that the sophists had given persuasion a bad name. So that's true today as well, as of course. Persuasion can be used in bad ways for bad goals. Children try to persuade parents about getting some treat or toy. People try to persuade themselves that a bad action is a good action. A politician persuades the court to imprison innocent, helpless people. In all these cases, persuasion could be blamed. And that is what Plato did. He was angry about whatever persuasion was. On the other hand, in ancient Greek society, there was this process developing at the time that we call democracy. Citizens of Athens tried to persuade other men to make certain decisions, to pass certain laws. And so speechmaking, the giving of public speeches, became more and more important. And it became clear to Aristotle and to others that this kind of speechmaking would play an important role in whether or not citizens would make good decisions. So Aristotle thought it necessary to come up with a theory of how speeches could persuade people properly so that it could be taught. In essence, Aristotle wanted to make it possible for people to be able to learn how to become better at persuading others so that they could become better citizens. Aristotle saw that persuasion could have a good side as well as a bad side. It could be used for bad purposes for sure, but it could also be used for good purposes. And so to teach it, you had to have a theory of it. And this is where we get Aristotle's book about rhetoric. So here's a question for later on, after our lecture. Do you need persuasion if you don't have a democracy? Why or why not? Let's go back to the first line of the rhetoric. The reason Aristotle is going on about the dialectic is because he's trying to show his readers that his ideas are connected to Plato's ideas. Aristotle is trying to contrast his ideas with Plato's ideas. Aristotle wants to show that rhetoric is worth studying. Aristotle is defining a subject to be studied. Aristotle says that rhetoric is an art, not a science. He also says that we can study rhetoric. How does he know that we can study rhetoric? Well, he points out at the beginning that all people try to defend themselves with words. They discuss statements. They attack other people. He says, ordinary people do this either at random or through practice and from acquired habit. Both ways being possible, the subject can plainly be handled systematically, he says. In other words, he's saying, most people try to get their opinions across, they try to convince other people, and they try to defend their own opinions. Some people do it pretty randomly. Some people do it by habit. And so what that means to Aristotle is that you can actually study the defense of opinions in a systematic way. Defending your own opinion and attacking someone else's opinion is a system. It's an art. So, he says, it will be possible to learn how to do that well and how to avoid doing it poorly. In other words, we can learn how to persuade. There is a proper method of how to persuade people. So here's another question for you later on. Have you ever persuaded someone through an argument? What are some problems that you faced while doing this? I think what's interesting here is that Aristotle is defining rhetoric from scratch, as it were. It's not like there was already a science or an art of rhetoric that already exists and Aristotle is going to revise it for us. It seems like Aristotle literally doesn't have a word for this process, and he is just realizing it is important. The analogy would be that someone has just invented the skill of skating on ice, and then afterwards they have to explain how to do it, how to teach someone. You know, people could not always skate. Modern ice skating on a thin metal blade was invented in the 19th century, and then they had to teach people how to skate. Think about persuasion in that context in ancient Greece. People have been doing persuading for a while now, and Aristotle is now going to write a sort of manual so that people will be able to learn how to persuade in a better way, and more people will be able to do it. Now, it might seem to you as you read that the writing style of Aristotle in the Rhetoric is quite difficult. Well, it may be so. Maybe he was just difficult to understand, too complex. But it also may be that he wrote this in a better or clearer way, and that better book was lost to us. So what we have from Aristotle is often based on the notes that he left and that his students wrote down. And that's according to Malcolm Heath, who translates the Poetics. So anyway, let's give Aristotle a break and hope that he was a better writer than this, a clearer one at any rate. And of course, let's account for the fact this is translated from Greek, and I don't read Greek. Let's talk about some of the key terms that Aristotle uses in chapter 1. He uses the word enthymeme. Then he goes on to say that the enthymeme is like a syllogism. And that's not much help to us, of course, this complicated definition. Well, the word syllogism is a word related to dialectic. It means a logical statement. And so based on these statements, we can come to a conclusion. A syllogism is the basic unit that we use in order to do dialectic. So remember I told you that dialogue is important to him. To Aristotle and to his readers, the dialectic is a real thing. It's something they understand already. So Aristotle is trying to explain rhetoric in terms of the dialectic so that his audience can grasp it. If you want to study philosophy, you can study syllogisms. This is still something people learn when they look at how logic works. So you need to know that the syllogism is something important in logic, and so Aristotle is using it to help explain his own concept of the enthymeme. So what is the enthymeme then? Well, basically, it's the main idea that the speaker is trying to get across. It contains a reason, usually. For example, one enthymeme would be, Aristotle will not live forever because he is human. The word enthymeme is not limited to Aristotle. In fact, there is a more recent theory of rhetoric by Stephen Toulmin, and he uses this word enthymeme as well. If you want to learn about writing speeches or making arguments, it's very worthwhile for you to learn Toulmin's method. Toulmin's method is covered in several textbooks of rhetoric, and I teach it in some of my communications courses. It's not a way of writing an essay. It's a way of thinking about a problem. It's a way of thinking about an idea and how to structure that idea. So one important thing to notice about the enthymeme from chapter 1 in the Rhetoric is that Aristotle believes it's rooted in reality. In Aristotle's view, truth, knowledge, and facts are things that you can observe and prove. This is very different from the kind of mystical knowledge that we discussed in my lecture on Orpheus and the Book of John in May. Remember that in the Christian worldview, there are different kinds of knowledge, and the knowledge that is hidden or confusing is a spiritual knowledge, one that comes from God. Now, Aristotle's theory of knowledge is different from that. He says specifically in chapter 1, quote, truth is not beyond human nature, and men do, for the most part, achieve it. Let's look at that again. Truth is not beyond us. We do achieve it. We can get to the truth. It is possible. It is worthwhile to try to find out the truth. So his theory of rhetoric is based in this. His theory of rhetoric will not be about imagination or creativity or God or spirituality. Aristotle's theory of persuasion is really about finding something persuasive that already exists, discovering the best persuasive aspect of something. Aristotle does not want there to be any mystery about persuasion. He wants it to be something that is real and objective and easy to learn. And so I think that is why Aristotle's theory has survived for so long and is popular and still taught now. The modern world's view of the art of persuasion is that it should be objective, easy to teach, useful, and somehow scientific. For us living in a modern world, persuasion is not based in mystery or a lack of knowledge. Another thing I want to highlight about chapter one of the Rhetoric is the metaphor that Aristotle uses to explain what persuasion is and how it works. Aristotle compares persuasion to medicine. By medicine, he means the practice of medicine, not just pills, but any sort of treatment by a doctor, physio, pills, surgery, nursing care, and so on. Now, Aristotle says that in medicine, the purpose is not to make someone healthy, but to make them as healthy as possible, to look after people who are sick, for example. You can't make someone totally healthy necessarily, but you can treat them. Similarly, persuasion is about showing the most persuasive aspect of a situation. Maybe this argument is not totally persuasive. Maybe the ideas are just not great to begin with. Well, the art of persuasion is about bringing out the best as far as possible. The art of rhetoric, of persuasion, will get you as far as you can go. So he says about rhetoric, quote, "Its function is not simply to succeed in persuading, but rather to discover the means of coming as near such success as the circumstances of each particular case allow." In chapter 2 of the Rhetoric, Aristotle presents the three famous genres or modes, ways in which rhetoric works. These are the three aspects of persuasion, the three main types of persuasive skills. These three ways are often taught as ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos has to do with the personal character of the speaker, Aristotle says, and pathos has to do with the disposition or feeling of the audience. In our text, this is translated as, quote, "putting the audience into a certain frame of mind." The third mode of persuasion is logos, the proof or apparent proof provided by the words of the speech itself. So this is the words and the reasons within the speech. Interestingly, Aristotle says that character contains the strongest proof of all. And I find this ironic because, of course, the speaker's character cannot really be taught. It exists already before the speaker starts speaking. How can you have a theory of persuasion for teaching people how to persuade if the most important factor is simply who they are in the first place? Anyway, let's keep going. Ethos, pathos, and logos are still commonly taught in high school and university English courses. Students are taught to analyze the ethos or the character of the writer by looking for the education of the writer and their biases or lack of bias. You can look at what credentials a writer or speaker has. What university did they go to? Do they seem to be a trustworthy person and why? Do they have a lot of work experience in a particular area? If you look at Obama versus Trump, you can compare their ethos. What sort of person is Obama? What sort of person is Trump? Your view of how persuasive these people are, your view depends on your view of their character, and that's ethos. Meanwhile, pathos has to do with what sort of emotions you feel when watching a play or reading a book. In the case of Oedipus Rex, perhaps we feel pity and fear when we watch what happens to him and what he does. Here we can see that the writer, Sophocles, is using pathos. He is evoking feelings in the audience in order to teach us a lesson, to tell us something. Finally, logos has more to do with the sort of evidence and examples that the writer provides. For example, in a student essay, perhaps a student provides some references for the facts and statistics that they give. This would be a kind of logos or evidence. Or alternatively, maybe a journalist interviews someone on the street, an eyewitness. The words of this person are used as evidence that some event happened. And finally, logos is a kind of reasoning. We might argue that Oedipus is a relevant play because studying the play is a worthwhile activity. So there I provided a reason for something. That reason is a kind of logos. The words themselves are used to try to persuade you to change your mind. In chapter 3 of the Rhetoric, Aristotle says there are three kinds of rhetoric having to do with the type of audience. One type he calls deliberative, another kind forensic, and another kind ceremonial or eidetic. In our text, these are called three divisions: political, forensic, and ceremonial. Political has to do with the future. What should we do and why? Which is the better course of action? Which is the better action? Shall we do this thing? Shall we not do it? Forensic has to do with the past. Is the person guilty or innocent? What did they do? And ceremonial has to do with the present, Aristotle says, though this seems a little too neat and tidy for me. Anyway, ceremonial is to do with praising someone and criticizing someone. You could give a speech to praise a person or to criticize them, for example. In chapter 4, Aristotle starts to explain about deliberative rhetoric or political rhetoric. Now, since Aristotle thinks that we need to find ways in which a situation is persuasive, he sets out to say what the speaker needs to know in order to find out the persuasive aspects of a situation. If someone wants to write a political speech to persuade us about what to do next, what the country should do next, then that person must be knowledgeable about a particular area. Taxes, defense, food supply, national security, the speaker just has to know his stuff. This might seem rather obvious to us now, but Aristotle is a philosopher and he doesn't want to leave anything out. And so we get his next section on chapter 5. Here, Aristotle starts to talk about what the good is. This is because the whole purpose of good persuasion should be to persuade us to do something good in life. But how can we know what good persuasion is if we do not know what the good life is? So Aristotle feels he must tell us what the good life is so that we may become better at persuading others. So you can see now that the art of persuasion, according to Aristotle, is really tied up with what it means to be a good human being, a good citizen. You cannot just teach someone to persuade others. That would be immoral. You must teach them to persuade people about good things. This is necessary not just for moral purposes, but because the way persuasion works is by finding good aspects of a situation that already exist. You are not going to make them up. If you are writing a speech, you are finding something and showing it. So implicitly, Aristotle expects that the audience and the writer already know what is good and that they will try to bring it out in their speech. But perhaps Aristotle also suspects that someone might try to bring out something bad, and perhaps that is why he decides to set out his philosophy on what is good, what is the highest good, and so on. Now, you'll remember from Plato that there is this discussion of happiness, the pursuit of the good life, and so on. Here, we are getting a different approach. So in chapter 5, Aristotle says that happiness is as follows, and I quote, "We may define happiness as prosperity combined with virtue, or as independence of life, or as the secure enjoyment of the maximum of pleasure, or as a good condition of property and body, together with the power of guarding one's property and body and making use of them. That happiness is one or more of these things. Pretty well everybody agrees," Aristotle says. I like that. We all agree. Like, I'm going to finish up there. We all agree, right? Another way of talking about independence of life is self-sufficiency. The idea behind the word independence seems to be that the happiness can be maintained on its own. It won't be taken away from you. You are not depending on anyone else or anything else for it. No one is giving you this happiness. It's yours and you can keep it. You can count on having it. Your happiness is secure. I find this a really interesting aspect of the definition of happiness. The point is that there are lots of good things, but none of them are very good if you feel insecure about them, or at any point someone else could take away those things. So, what's interesting about this section of Aristotle's rhetoric is that it's a complete digression, a sort of mini essay on the good of society, the good of life, as Aristotle sees them. And you might think it's a little boring. I mean, stop telling us about ceremonies and gifts, right? Of course, those things make us happy. Isn't that obvious? But this section tells us a lot about the society Aristotle lives in. And the fact is that for Aristotle, you cannot really separate material things from happiness. It's natural that those material things make us happy and it's natural that we don't want them to be taken away from us. So let's turn to the Poetics now. One of the things the Poetics does is it tries to explain about Greek tragedy. And since we read Sophocles last month, this kind of thing might be useful to understand Oedipus. However, the Poetics is not a manual for a playwright. It's not something that will tell us how to write a play. What the Poetics is a kind of philosophy that will help us to understand and appreciate plays. And in this way, the Poetics is a kind of literary criticism. Literary criticism is the area of scholarship that studies literature. Why is literature good? Why do we appreciate it? How do we appreciate it? That is literary criticism. And so Aristotle's Poetics is one of the early Western examples of literary criticism. But as you can see, Aristotle is also a philosopher. And the way the Poetics is written, it is very much a kind of philosophy. And that also is interesting because if you study literary criticism in a university today, you will see that literary criticism is basically written by philosophers and academics who are not poets. I mean, Derrida is a philosopher, not a writer or a poet. He's actually kind of a terrible writer, in my uneducated opinion, just really boring and difficult to understand. What I mean to say is those who write literary criticism are not literary writers, they're philosophers. The same goes for Heidegger or Jean-Paul Sartre or Simone de Beauvoir. Maybe not Simone de Beauvoir or Sartre. I think they're pretty good, actually. Anyway, if you take a course in literary theory, a course in how to appreciate and understand literature, you're basically reading philosophy. Let's talk about the word poetry, because this book, of course, is called the Poetics. I want to emphasize for you that Aristotle's theory does not actually just apply to what we think of as poetry. First of all, in Aristotle's time, there's no such thing as a novel or a movie. There were plays, there was epic poetry like the Iliad, and there was lyric poetry such as short poems and songs. Later on, however, epic poetry turned into the novel, maybe around the 18th century in England and Europe. Lyric poetry turned into modern pop songs, maybe around 1930 or 1880 or something. And what he calls poetry is something that would evolve into a lot of other forms of literature. For example, Stephen King's novel, The Stand. This is something that wouldn't have existed in Aristotle's time, but he would say it's covered by the theory of the Poetics. I would probably call that novel kind of like an epic. Anyway, so one of the main concepts of the Poetics is this idea of mimesis or imitation. Aristotle says that poetry is mimesis. He says it's an imitation of life. You can also use the word representation. And so remember, we're not just talking about poetry. We're talking about movies, novels, TV, plays, poems, songs. It's all imitation, according to Aristotle. So art imitates life, according to Aristotle. So here's a question for later. Do you agree that art, all forms of it, music, art, stories, do you agree that art is basically imitation and that the best art imitates the best things? And if so, can you think of an example? And keep in mind that there's lots of theories of art, like the expressionist theory of art, which is that art expresses feelings, it doesn't imitate life. That's not a mimetic theory of art. So Aristotle is very much invested with this idea of mimesis or imitation. He thinks that imitation is something we do that makes us human. So imitation is an activity that is unique to humans. It defines us as human. So really, when Aristotle talks about poetry, he is also trying to define what it means to be human. And that's a kind of philosophy, a kind of statement about people, about who we are and what makes us different from animals. So secondly, he says, not only is imitation unique to humans, but so is rhythm and melody. So it makes sense in Aristotle's mind that rhythm and melody appear in poetry and imitation appear in poetry because these are the things that make us human. So it's a kind of philosophy again. But instead of discussing the definition of the good now, Aristotle is discussing the definition of the human, of humankind. So when I read over this passage in chapter 1 of the Poetics, I basically think Aristotle is on crack. He is really stretching it. To me, music is one of the least imitative arts. I can see how poetry imitates because it tells stories about people, but music is really abstract, like mathematics. It uses symbols. Music is not imitative at all to me. Yes, it has rhythm and it has melody, but these are not imitative. They are their own system, all on their own. They do not refer outside of themselves. Now, of course, I agree, a sad song will remind you of sadness. It's very interesting. Maybe that's imitative somehow. I don't know. Maybe. But I think music is actually really expressive. That is, it expresses a feeling or a thought within you rather than imitating some action in life. So maybe it's imitating feeling, but we don't really know what feelings are. We don't have a lot of words to describe feelings. They're very complex. So how can we say we're imitating it when we don't really know what it is that we're imitating? So here's a question for later. Is classical music a kind of imitation in your mind? Why or why not? What I do think is that Aristotle really wants us to think that music is imitative, and there's something kind of important for him that music is imitative. So why might that be? I think one clue is in part one, where he says some people define poetry as just the verse form. Aristotle is really invested in saying that this is not the case. Poetry is not just the hexameter or verse form. Hexameter, by the way, means 6 feet. In modern English poetry, the word means that a line of poetry has 12 syllables because a foot normally has 2 feet. However, hexameter meant something slightly different in Aristotle's time in ancient Greek poetry. So let's not talk too much about that. But basically, Aristotle really doesn't want to talk about the length of the line of a poem. For him, that is not what a poem is. And I think that's very interesting because a lot of literary theories do want to talk about the form of a poem. And by form, I mean shape. So a lot of literary theories want to talk about things like, how long is the poem? How many lines does it have? How many syllables are in a line? How does the line sound? For example, an English sonnet is 14 lines long. A Shakespearean sonnet has one form, and a Petrarchan sonnet has another. Generally, a Shakespearean sonnet ends in a couplet, 2 lines that rhyme. And so many literary theorists say this is what makes a poem, the special shape and sound of the line. And Aristotle is not interested about that. He does not want to talk about that form of the poem because he is invested in the philosophy behind the poem. He is interested in the fact, for him, that only humans make poems, and this somehow makes humans special. And what can we learn from that? He wants people to appreciate the higher purpose of the poem. The poem's purpose is not simply to sound a certain way, to have a certain shape, to have a certain length of the line. The poem's purpose is to help us understand what our human nature is. And in fact, as Aristotle goes on to discuss the form of tragedy, we see that watching tragedy also has this purpose of having us learn and understand fully what our human nature is. Aristotle says in part 2 of the Poetics that Homer is a great poet because his stories imitate better people. He means that Homer's Iliad is great because of all the noble warriors in it. The Iliad shows us the greatness of the warrior Achilles, among others. Now, we came across this idea last month when we discussed Sophocles and Oedipus Rex. And I told you that tragedy is the imitation of an action that is noble, complete, and serious. Oedipus is a king, and this is an essential aspect of tragedy because Oedipus is a noble person. Well, this play illustrates Aristotle's idea of tragedy in poetry. This is what tragedy is. It imitates the actions of great people. Let's talk a bit about Aristotle's idea that only humans imitate and only humans have rhythm and melody. Lots of scientific research now shows us that, in fact, many animals imitate each other or humans. They do so not only to survive, but also for entertainment. Birds imitate humans in a way that appears to be a kind of way of having fun, playing around. Meanwhile, birds also have rhythm and melody. Certain species of birds imitate melodies and make up new ones by combining other melodies together. Birds seem to be the only other animal group, genus, that actually has rhythm in a way that humans have. And this is an interesting coincidence, I think. Now, I don't think it disproves Aristotle's idea that mimesis is a fundamentally human activity. Certainly, humans are defined by our ability to tell stories at a complex level, far more complex than birdsong or chimp sign language. However, I think it's even more interesting to see that our ability to tell stories has a biological origin. It's not entirely created by humans. We did not single-handedly create drama and create stories. Our brain gives us some sort of instinctive ability to imitate, just as birds do. So mimesis is a kind of an instinctive thing, just as our ability to make melody and rhythm is an instinctive thing as well. I do think that the idea that poetry is mimetic or imitative is kind of limited. I think poetry is not just a kind of imitation. And remember, we're not just talking about poetry here. We're talking about all the things that develop out of poetry. You know, TV, music, song, lyric, books, epic, novels, essays, you know, student assignments, all of that comes out of what Aristotle thinks of as poetry. But keep in mind that the Poetics that Aristotle wrote is quite short. So according to Malcolm Heath, our translator, there appears to have been another book Aristotle wrote called On Poets, and that book disappeared. So that book, if we had it, would probably give us a much more complete theory of poetry. For the last part of my lecture, I'm going to discuss a few terms that are pretty important for a theory of English poetry and drama. The first one is purgation or purging. Aristotle thought that watching tragedy helped the audience get out their own emotions, and he thought that had a healthy psychological function. He used the word purgation. To purge an emotion means to express it and get rid of it. In modern English, if you say that you purged your dinner, it means you vomited it, you threw it up. And if you look at part 6 of the Poetics, this is where the word purgation comes up. The Greek word for it is catharsis. Now, modern psychology has studied this kind of thing. It's not clear that watching something sad helps you purge or get rid of your emotions, but maybe sometimes. I suppose this would be a question for us later on, though. Do you think poetry helps us get rid of our emotions, purge them, or get them out? The next word I want to discuss is peripeteia. And the example given here is in Oedipus Rex. So peripeteia means reversal. How do we see that in tragedy? Well, at the start of the play Oedipus Rex, a messenger, Creon, comes along. We talked about this last month in the lecture. At the start of the play, Creon arrives and he speaks and he tells us what's gone on. He says at the beginning, good news. But although he begins with the words good news, he then makes that sound very ambiguous indeed. He says in lines 89 to 90, good may come even out of painful matters if all goes well. So in fact, even though he says good news, he means it could be very bad news. And in fact, the play shows us it is very bad news. So the play shows us a reversal from good news to bad news. Reversals are important concepts in literature because they have to do with expectations. The expectations of the reader are important. Whenever you read something, you do it because you have an expectation of what will happen to the character. You expect a certain ending. You want a certain ending. Perhaps you even want to be disappointed by the ending, so long as it is entertaining. Basically, you expect to be entertained. So expectations define whether or not you are surprised. Expectations define whether or not there is suspense in a play. Suspense and surprise have a lot to do with whether or not you enjoy watching a movie or reading a book. Maybe you read a detective novel because it has suspense and you want to be surprised by the ending. Well, Aristotle is one of the first people in Western literature to point this out for us. This is his concept of the reversal. We want to be surprised. We want things to be turned around. Another term I want to discuss is anagnorisis, which means recognition. And we can also see this concept in the play Oedipus Rex, which we read last month. At the end of the play, Oedipus realizes who he really is. He realizes his children are his half-brothers and his wife is his mother. It's a very disturbing moment. Oedipus realizes that his whole life is a lie. That's a recognition. He recognizes who he is, and it's terrible. Now, in modern dramas, the recognition is not always so terrible, not all the time, but there usually is a moment at some point in which the character realizes what his or her true nature is. Sometimes this realization can lead to a good outcome, sometimes not. You can probably think of at least one movie in which a character realizes who he really is, either early on in the story or later on. To end the lecture, I'm going to point out that in part 6, Aristotle says there are 6 parts of tragedy. Interestingly, all these parts still play a role in our definition of the parts of literature. Plot is still important. Plot is not just what happens in the story. Plot is the careful arrangement of things in order to give a certain effect. It's not just a sequence of episodes or events. That would be boring, just like events in life with no pattern at all. Plot is carefully ordered, sequenced, and patterned. And character, one of the parts of tragedy, is still important too. We think of there being different characters in novels, and in fact, the fortunes of character are carefully related to the shape of the plot as well. And then as another part of tragedy is diction. Diction has to do with the words that are used. Again, words are picked for a very specific effect. So diction gives us puns, imagery, metaphors, and so on. Well, I'm going to finish up here. I hope this gives you some ideas about how Aristotle's theory of poetry and rhetoric are still relevant today. And I'm looking forward to our discussion.